In the year 1598, by Christian reckoning, Juan de Oñate led a group of Spanish colonists and their livestock northward, east of the Continental Divide, to settle near the confluence of the Rio Chama and the Rio Grande. The landscape was already populated with indigenous peoples whose distant ancestors had first entered the region in remote antiquity. For the first century of Spanish colonization, there were frequent conflicts between Native Americans and colonists that ultimately resulted in the Pueblo Revolt of 1680, when surviving colonists fled southward to take refuge in El Paso del Norte. Gradually, the colonists returned and settled into the landscape to which they themselves would finally become indigenous. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. On this episode, we shall try to provide some insight into the extraordinary perseverance that was required of generations of Hispanos to root their culture into the landscape of what is now New Mexico. When they first arrived, geopolitical boundaries were non-existent. Instead, there were already existing cultural boundaries between Puro, Puebloan, Navajo, Apache, Ute, and other Indians. There were geophysical boundaries that came with the arid landscape itself. The colonists brought with them their own cultural boundaries dominated from within by the Catholic Church. Fran Levine is an ethnohistorian and director of the Palace of the Governor's History Museum of New Mexico. She has spent many years reflecting on the nature of these cultural boundaries.
The frontier of New Mexico and the frontier of Mexico met somewhere on the Camino Real. And when you're in the Rio Abajo region, you really are in that transition zone. In ecology, we talk about an ecotone. And an ecotone is where one plant community joins with another. And so you have a little bit of desert and a little bit of pino and juniper that grow and intermingle. And I think of a frontier as a kind of cultural ecotone, a place where the culture of one area and the culture of another area begin to meet and combine to form something wholly new that is a combination of the two distinct culture areas.
As Hispanos rooted themselves to the land in the region of the northern Rio Grande, they reciprocated with their Indian neighbors in many ways that often included the sharing of bloodlines. Esteban Real Galvez is the New Mexico State historian. He has spent many years researching the great mestizaje, that genetic mixture that resulted in La Raza Nueva.
I grew up largely with two grandmothers continually whispering stories into my ear of who we were, and it was a story that was more than Mexicano, more than Español, more than even Indo-Hispano. Están quebrados en ti, my grandmother would say, and I gradually learned about these different captives that were in our family and that they would continue to pass down to me. One of these stories was told to me by my great-grandmother, Dulcinea Arellano, who always told me the same story when I would go visit her. She would say, talk to me about La India Panana. I would come to learn that Panana was a Spanish word for Pawnee. La India Panana, who didn't have a name then, had been captured by some Indian clan in the south, she would say, pointing with her lips south. She had been captured by them, and they also ended up capturing one of her great-great-grandfathers, whose name was Arellano. She told him, if you take me with you, I'll show you how to escape. And that's exactly what happened. They escaped and found their way, and that's how La Panana ended up in our family. La India, as the records show, married into the Arellano family and was living in Arroyo Hondo. And so as I was trying to think about identity, a profound identity in northern New Mexico, I tried to reach deep into these stories, into a consciousness and a memory that had been passed down to me. And the more I started to dig into the records, the more I realized there was not a single family, not a single individual living in northern New Mexico that had not inherited this legacy.
The late Benjamin Archuleta of Abiquiú related the story of his grandfather, who was captured by the Navajo Indians when he was a boy.
Two little kids, one, my grandfather was about 10 years old, and the other one was about 12. They was taking the hobbles off from the burros to bring them back when the Indians were coming right close to them, and they started running. They kept pointing with their arrows to them that they was, thought they were going to shoot them. And finally they catch him, but they didn't catch the other kid. And as soon as they catch him, they went back and took the two burros, and then they went clear out to a place we call Vallecito. They camped that night there. They killed one of them burros. They had plenty of meat. And next morning they went toward the Navajo reservation. They just kept going that in that direction until they got to where they live. My father, I don't know just how long he stayed with that first one Indian, claimed him like a son, sent him with that daughter of his to herd the goats and horses. And my grandfather said she was pretty mean to him. Every little bit she just whip him. And my father didn't do nothing. He just take all she gave him. And finally he got tired. And one day she was going to whip him. And he turned around and got in a fight with her and whip her. And as soon as she got off from the ground, she got on her horse. From there on, the girl changed her ways. She never whipped him anymore, and she started treating him better. Finally, at that time, Uncle Sam was trying to get the Indians in peace. They had a camp of soldiers right close to where they live. The soldier told him, if you don't want to go back with those Indians, don't go. Just stay here. He stayed there in the camp until this fella got ready to come home. This fella come on a horse, and he put him behind the saddle too, and bring him to low here to Abiquiú. He said the people were pretty glad to see my grandfather back here.
Narrative ballads often serve as means of cultural recollection. Virginia Vernal sang this song that recalls the plight of a woman named Marcelina, who was captured by hostile Indians after they had killed members of her family. It is entitled La Cautiva Marcelina.
La cautiva Marcelina, ya se la llevan, ya se va, ya se la llevan. Para esas tierras mentadas, a comer carne de yegua, a comer carne de yegua. Por eso ya no quiero en el mundo más amar. De mi querida patria me van a retirar. La cautiva Marcelina, cuando llego a la guapa, cuando llego a la guapa, volteó la cara llorando. Mataron a mi papá, mataron a mi papá. Por eso ya no quiero en el mundo más amar. Que mi querida patria me van a retirar. La cautiva Marcelina, cuando ya llego a los llanos, cuando ya llego a los llanos. Volteó la cara llorando, mataron a mis hermanos, mataron a mis hermanos. Por eso ya no quiero en el mundo más amar. De mi querida patria me van a retirar. La cautiva Marcelina, cuando llego al ojito, cuando llego al ojito. Volteó la cara llorando, mataron al delgadito, mataron al delgadito. Por eso ya no quiero en el mundo más amar. De mi querida patria me van a retirar. La cautiva Marcelina, cuando llego a los cerritos, cuando llego a los cerritos. Volteó la cara llorando, mataron a mis hijitos, mataron a mis hijitos. Por eso ya no quiero en el mundo más amar. De mi querida patria me van a retirar.
Gradually, Hispano culture evolved to meet the criteria dictated by the land, which they had come to hold in deep reverence. They had brought their religion with its pantheon of saints with them. Charlie Carrillo is a master santero who has rendered many a retablo that evokes the spirit of the portrayed saint.
I think that the most important thing I can say about santos, the figures, both bultos and retablos, or láminas if they're painted on tin or paper prints, is New Mexicans have always kept santos in their homes, not as objects of art, but as objects of devotion. And those objects of devotion aren't just things that hang on the walls and sit on shelves. They are very much like family members who live in the home. And I have a sneaky suspicion the reason we treat santos that way, and the reason people in most of the New World treat santos that way, it's the very Native American way of making those objects become real members of the house as if they lived with us and dwelt among us. Very much like the Kachina tradition, where the Kachinas come down from the mountains and come to live with people, the santos don't come to live with us, they are living with us. When we bring them into their house, they basically live with us. That's how we treat santos. Now, when you have people living in the house with you, you talk to them. You don't ignore them unless it's a dysfunctional family. So we talk with our santos. We don't pray to them, but pray with them. The santos are here on the walls, but it's not unusual that we'll talk to the santo, and I'll come in here and say, okay, Santo Niño de Atocha, because this room that we're sitting in is filled with Santo Niño de Atocha. I need a favor from you, or I need you to do something for me, or I need you to look into this for me. And it's a conversation, not as a formalized prayer, but a conversation we have. The saints speak to us and we speak to them. We carry on conversations. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have formalized prayer. There are the formalized prayers that we have that are very much in keeping with the Catholic, Spanish colonial kind of Hispano traditions, the formalized prayers. And along with the formalized prayers, those formalized songs we call alabados. That's part of the whole tradition. The spirituality of the santos is they are our friends that live among us, and they're people we turn to because we understand they have that connection not only on earth but in heaven with God. And in other words, they're the mediators. We can turn to them and ask for favors or ask for things to be done for us or help. Like a farmer saint, San Isidro. You know, why turn to San Isidro? Well, he was a farmer. He understood what it was to be a farmer. You know, you don't turn to a person who was a musician all his life or her life, like Santa Cecilia, and ask her to help with the beans and the chile, because she probably never did that. But San Isidro dealt with the farm, and so he knows the particulars of what farmers, laborers, and all that deal with. So that's why you turn to certain saints. There's a saint for everything in New Mexico.
Eulogio Ortega is a santero who lives in Velarde near the banks of the Rio Grande. He is a deeply religious man who takes much of his spiritual sustenance from the flow of nature.
I take walks and I think of the miracle of life, because life is a miracle, you know. Even though I carve santos, that doesn't mean that santos is what makes my spiritual life, you know. My spiritual life mostly comes from nature. Carving is just a creative thing, you know. But through my window, I always see this tree, how in the fall it sort of dies, you know. And then in the spring it comes to life again. I see the buds and the blossoms, and then eventually the apples. And it's like a cycle, you know. Life is like a cycle. And miracle is everywhere. It's all around me, you know, the clouds and the mountains and the sky. And we are surrounded by a miracle. And we have to be conscious of that fact at all times, you know. The Virgen of Guadalupe is very important in this area. The story goes back in Mexico over 500 years ago. So some of the settlers that came from Mexico, they started building churches, you know, in honor of Our Lady of Guadalupe and making statues. When the first settlers came here, the first thing that they did was build their homes. And then after their homes, they would build a chapel that was located more or less in the center of the community. Our Lady of Guadalupe became very, very popular. There's quite a few churches that are dedicated to Our Lady of Guadalupe. And the Catholic Church here in Velarde is dedicated to Our Lady of Guadalupe.
The story is told that the people in the village were experiencing a very bad year. They knew it was going to be a drought year because the previous years had been years of drought. So on the feast of San Isidro, as typically they would do, the night before the feast, they took San Isidro to the church on his anda, his platform they carried to take the saint out, and they lit candles for him and had a velorio, the wake, basically, for the saint, and prayed rosaries all night long until the breaking of the dawn. And at dawn, the community got up and sang the very traditional alabado, El Alba, Cantemos Alba, Ya Viene Dia, Daremos Gracias, Ave Maria. And then not long after that, they took San Isidro out in a procession in the early morning light to bless all the fields and asked him to bring rain to the parched fields that they had planted already. It was May the 15th, that's what his feast day is. And the story is told that they did this and then returned back to the church that afternoon and had a big fiesta for San Isidro with eating and feasting and music and waited for the rain to come and nothing happened. And they knew it was going to happen sometime soon, so patiently waited while weeks went by and nothing happened. And here we are at the end of May and still hasn't rained, so people are very concerned. So the community gets together and decides, what are we going to do? And they decide, well, maybe we didn't do the procession right. Maybe we didn't sing the right songs. Let's do it again. So they basically redid what they had done and went through the whole processional again and singing the songs and everything else and waited days and nothing happened. And, well, they thought, well, maybe we still haven't done it right. Let's try it a third time. Three is always a magic number in the sense it represents a Trinity. You know, it's the, you know, Father, Son, Holy Spirit. So let's really be good Catholic New Mexicans and let's do it a third time. So they did it a third time and nothing happened. In their dismay, they gather the community together to find out, what are we going to do to get these fields watered? You know, San Isidro is our patron of irrigation, of farming, and he brings rain for us, and it's not working. And somebody cleverly said, you know what, we've worn him out. We've literally worn this saint out. We've asked him for so many years to bring rain to our fields. We probably wore out our welcome with him, and let's do something different this year. Why don't we take El Santo Niño de Atocha, the baby Jesus, because, you know, baby Jesus is a young boy. Young boys tend to get things done. If you give him a good assignment, he's old enough to do it. Let's take him out. And the story is told that they prepare a beautiful anda, and they take San Isidro out of his anda, and they put the Santo Niño in his chair on the anda and decorate it with flowers, and they process the field, and they tell him, Mira Santo Niño, look, Santo Niño, our fields are dry. The saint you have given to us to take care of our field is being real flojo this year. He's being lazy. We must have made him mad. We must have angered him some way. What do we do? Look at these fields. San Isidro hasn't come through for us. Can you please do something for us? And before they could turn around at the second field, the clouds had built up and the skies had opened up and it was raining the 500-year rain. It was the worst rain the people had ever seen in the entire history of the village, and it literally washed away the fields, wiped out a lot of the village. It was the 500-year rain. It was the rain of all rains. They were horrified because all the work they had done previous to that month of planting all the fields and preparation all the fields, everything was wiped out. So the entire village spent the night in the church, and the very next morning they decided to take matters into their own hand and take care of this and see what they could do, how they could salvage the situation. And so they took the statue of the Virgin Mary and dressed her in the finest robe they could find in the church and put her on the same manda they had put the Santo Niño on, the same manda that San Isidro had occupied. And they took her out into the muddy fields where all the mud was and there was still standing water. And a child asked, as they were processing down through the muddy fields, you know, you took San Isidro out, he didn't do any good. You took the baby Jesus out, the Santo Niño Atocha, and look what he did. Why are you taking the Virgin Mary out? And the response was, para enseñarle la cagada que hicieron su hijo anoche, to show the Virgin Mary the crap or the mess her little boy made last night, because he made a terrible mess the night before. And the story basically ends there, and the way it ends is that year, after it was all said and done, it was the most productive, beautiful gardens that village had ever had in the past 100 years. And people wonder, when I tell that story, well, what's the significance of that story? You know, why would you tell the story of three different saints? Well, first of all, the story is told of San Isidro because he was a patron saint of farmers. So you get to explain that we had a saint for everything, including a farmer saint. The second thing you do is explain the Santo Niño, who he was in the history of New Mexico and Chimayo and the devotion New Mexicans have to the Santo Niño Atocha, how he's turned to in every case for anything disastrous or anything that people need. He's the catch-all saint, the one we most often turn to because he's, in a sense, the Christ child, the human God who's Christ. And you talk about his divinity, but also his humanity. The reason we understand Christ the way we do is he was not only divine, but he was also truly human. And we understand that humans make mistakes. The divinity doesn't have to make mistakes, but the humanity does, because we're all humans. And even Christ in his humanity made the mistake. And he was a kid. He blew it. He totally blew it. Finally, guess who comes to the rescue? Mama comes to the rescue, okay? And so they take the Virgin Mary out to show her the mess her little boy made the night before. And in a sense, that really reinforces family. That mom kind of comes through at the end and everything else. But it also has a sense to show how people, how devout people were to the Virgin Mary, how they turned to her in their times of need. The flip side of it is, if you will, the other part of the story is the scientific explanation of what floods do. When floods bring down waters and everything, they bring nutrients to the soil and organic matter that gets mixed in with the floodwaters. It gets spread all over the fields. The fields are richer. Those fields have been wiped out with nutrients by being farmed and over-farmed and over-farmed. And no matter how good the farms were before the flood, they probably wouldn't have had a good crop because it had been over, the nutrients had been robbed from the soils. Typically in a floodplain, what happens is the floods come and deposit that new, fresh organic matter. The fields are renewed. You have a better harvest in the following years. But the truth about it is, what the kid does is he brings nutrients to the soil, ultimately, because he provided a flood. Flood changes the way things are done. People reorganize. Community gets together. They rebuild. They get reunified. Their faith gets reinforced, and they come out better on the end. So I think it's a fabulous New Mexican story. It's a great story.
Geopolitical boundaries, including state lines and international borders, are a fairly recent phenomenon along the continental divide. In earlier centuries, the territory known as Nuevo Mexico extended from the Arkansas River to the east as far as the Colorado River to the west. My great friend Enrique Lamadrid is both a highly respected scholar and one of the most insightful fellow humans I've ever known.
Borders really complicate our lives. In the El Paso area, there's three units that come together there, the state of Chihuahua, the state of Texas, the state of New Mexico. It makes people's lives really complicated. The whole concept of a border doesn't even come along until the 19th century, the border as we know it, as the line of demarcation of a republic, of a nation. Before that, people didn't worry about it too much. If you lived in a monarchy, monarchies had very fuzzy borders, and what counted was your loyalty to the crown, to the religion of the crown, to the government, and it didn't matter where you went, you would always be a Spaniard or a Frenchman or an Englishman. But now that we have these borders, now that they are defended, they've complicated our lives immeasurably. And sure, you may say that the border west of El Paso is an imaginary line crossing the desert, but let me tell you, it's a well-patrolled imaginary line that's disrupted the lives of thousands and thousands of people. And it also disrupts our historical consciousness. New Mexico and Chihuahua, the two regions, northern regions, united by the Camino Real de Tierra Adentro, are one cultural, historical unit. They're not a geopolitical unit anymore because they now belong to two republics. But the culture and the history certainly unites these two regions that are so separated by this border. What we must remember is that this border moved more than 500 miles. The border used to be along the Arkansas River, which flows east from Pueblo. And so when those Santa Fe Trail, when those Chihuahua Trail, when those Camino Real de Tierra Adentro traders, when those American and New Mexican businessmen crossed that Arkansas River, they then entered the United States. Mexico began up there. The border is really a concept that goes well beyond geography into the geography of the soul, into psychology. As border people, we carry these borders inside our psyches. Every time we open our mouths as border people, we decide, are we going to speak in Spanish? Are we going to speak in English? ¿Qué vamos a decir? What are we going to say? And who are we going to say it to? We're always negotiating that border that's inside of us.
A major characteristic of this great landscape is its aridity. To survive here requires a cultural predisposition to water conservation. Native American and Hispano cultures have ably demonstrated their collective abilities to share this fragile resource in such a way that no one goes without. Western culture has much to learn from these indigenous communities of practice. As my friend author John Nichols said, resist much, consume little. The Lore of the Land is sponsored by the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the New Mexico Humanities Council, with funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the continued support of the Ford Foundation. For The Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.